Welcome to the Bill Bennett Show. Anything going on in America these days,
Paul? There's a lot happening right now.
This is the podcast that translates President Trump. Never has he needed less translation. We take a look at the current administration. We address the existential threats to America. We talk about what's going on, and a lot is going on. Glad to have John Hinderacher with us today. He's one of the smartest guys around. He's one of the founders of Powerline. Great site.
Very popular blog.
Is it a blog? Mm-hmm. It's not a site.
A website, blog. I mean, they have a website, and they post articles and blogs there.
And he's the president of the Center of the American Experiment. Let me discuss a few things first. I do want to talk about this Princeton case. I don't know. Have you followed this at all?
I just saw a little bit about it this morning.
Okay, this is, in some ways, it's really kind of funny. Mm-hmm. Because the president of Princeton, like all these universities, stood up and said, we're going to do something about our institutional racism. You know, the institution has been racist, has a racist history, and we're racist. That's where Michelle Obama went to school.
Uh-huh.
And she's, of course, much honored there. And she wrote and talked about her experiences at Princeton and apparently had some complaints or issues. I'm sorry. I've been up there a lot because both our boys went there. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen. I mean, it just, you know, that place. I just cannot imagine. Anyway, it's not a racist place. But the president of Princeton said it is. So we got a Civil Rights Act, and institutions that receive funds from the federal government have to abide by the 1964, et cetera, Civil Rights Acts. So they're launching an investigation, the federal government, the Department of Education, to see. So this was, you know, clearly what they call virtue signaling, and look at us, aren't we wonderful? Mm-hmm. The president said, he did a version of, I didn't really mean that. I mean, the society is racist.
Right.
You know.
We aren't.
I mean, you talk about a kind of, you know, ideal utopian environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful little town, all these beautiful people walking around, white and black and tan and Asian. And I remember Charles Krauthammer said, he took a son there, a son I think eventually went to Harvard, and he said, we walked around campus and they were very nice to us. He said, but we were just not good looking enough to get in there. You know? So it's a kind of preppy place,
sure.
School. But the notion that it's deeply embedded in racism and that black students there or students of color experience some kind of harsh treatment. Well, we'll find out. There'll be an investigation. But, you know, all these institutions are doing this mea culpa. Well, all right, you're going to confess the sin of racism. We're going to look into it before we give you any more federal money. Mm-hmm. Seems reasonable to me.
Uh-huh, right.
But it's kind of a joke in a way. It's kind of like, oh, my God, not really. And it's, I think it's West Side Story, the musical, where Danny and Maria, they're the, you know, she's Puerto Rican, he's Italian, I think, and they have a romance, but the gang, one's Italian, one's Puerto Rican, and Danny gets killed, and I think it's Maria or somebody says at the end, it wasn't so-and-so who killed him, we all did. So the president of Princeton is now saying, no, well, it's not our institution, it's like all of us, right? So don't single us out particularly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, careful what you say.
Right.
Confess to it. Look into it. I don't know what they're going to find. They're going to interview these black students, you know, sons of ambassadors and stuff. And they're going to say, have you experienced? Mm-hmm. Maybe some of them will say, yeah, it's terrible. You know, guy moved away from me in the snack bar. You know, I don't know what they're going to say.
Right.
But, and I don't mean to make light of serious issues because these are historically, but these institutions, I've been around them. They're not. They don't pay him like that. Anyway, we'll see what happens to the lawsuit. We'll talk to Hinderacher about that.
Right.
And we'll talk about the Supreme Court, which is the big deal. But I'll give you my view quickly. They're doing the right thing. The president's the president, and the Senate's the Senate. He has no obligation to nominate someone, but he certainly has the right to, the constitutional power to. The Senate does not have to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly has the ability and right to and the constitutional power to do so. There are people who said, well, it's just an exercise in raw political power. No, it's an exercise in power, certainly, by saying, yeah, we're going to take advantage of our constitutional authority. But this is about the Constitution. The only thing the Constitution says, the president nominates and the Senate advises and consents or not. The rest is politics. But in terms of justification, like, you know, the Democrats saying this is unwarranted. I'll get into this with Hinderacher, Claude, but, you know, the party that gave us Borking, going after Clarence Thomas, what they did to Brett Kavanaugh, all of a sudden gets on its high horse about how things should proceed? I don't think so. Not mine. Any comment?
Well, I was just wondering your comments or your thoughts when, of course, everyone's going back to 2016 when President Obama tried to nominate Garland. And but, you know, and so there's video in 2016 of Democrats saying we've got to do it now, got to do it now, got to do it now. We shouldn't wait till the election. And now some of the same ones are saying we should wait till after the election. And but there's also video and audio of Republicans saying we should do it. We should wait till after the election, wait till after the election. And now some of the same ones are saying, let's do it now, do it now.
I agree.
What do you think about the whole juxtaposition?
I'm not going to make the fine point distinction here. I mean, Mitch McConnell can make the point, and he did say it, that, well, I said we shouldn't go ahead with Garland because we have a president and a senate of different parties. Mm-hmm. And when they're both the same party, go ahead with it. That wasn't so emphatically clear in 2016. But, yeah, politics on both sides here.
Right.
But the whole question, the major question, you don't take politics out of politics. Mm-hmm. But the major question is, do they have the authority to do this? Absolutely.
Right.
Do they have the right to do it? Yes. Is it prudent to do it? That's a fair question. I think it probably is. Mm-hmm. A lot of debate now, Claude, about whether what the Democrats are going to do. They're threatening to do all sorts of things if they get elected, if they get the Senate and the presidency, like packing the court,
right,
ending the Electoral College, giving statehood to D.C., to Puerto Rico, to Guam, to Samoa, to whoever else they can think of. All sorts of threats. But there's another line of thinking. If I were advising the Democrats, I wouldn't show up for the hearings.
Okay, right.
I think there's risk. You get some woman, some sympathetic woman, Amy Barrett, like she's mother of seven children. Democrats go in and try to do to an Amy Coney Barrett what they did to Kavanaugh. Could put themselves in more trouble.
I think
you can argue that the net effect politically of the Kavanaugh hearings was that the Democrats lost a couple seats.
Sure.
So it's risky. So maybe they just say, we regard this as illegitimate. We're not going to show up for the hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to vote. Let the Republicans vote 51. And that's it. And she's confirmed.
You know, wouldn't there be room for Republicans to say, you know, in 2016, we wanted to wait, but we were the party in power in the Senate, and that's what we pushed for, and that's what happened. And now we're still the party of power in the Senate, and we want to push it through now, and we can do so.
It's our decision.
As opposed to make it seem as if, you know, I don't know, all things are equal.
Well, yes. You know, you could say, yeah, we had the power then, we have the power now. We exercised it one way then, the other way now. But the argument against that is they were invoking a principle.
Right.
And that the principle was don't nominate, you know, close to an election. Mitch McConnell would quibble with that and say, no, don't nominate just for an election if the Senate and the president are of opposite parties.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a mess.
I don't know. But the only thing that matters here constitutionally or legally is he's got the power to nominate, and they have the power to accept or reject.
Right. I mean, you remember a caller from the radio show who said, you know, I forgot, it might have been when President Obama was reelected. Said, you know, I just checked out of politics. I'm just going to take it.
I do.
This was the first moment where I understood what he meant. You know, when I'm seeing on both sides, just like, wow, everyone's just flipping from where they were 4 years ago, and no one's kind of like, you know, this is what we said on principle, and we're going to hold to it. For the first time earlier this week, I just said, you know what? I am disappointed just in the whole thing. And
you were shocked to see politics going on?
Maybe just weary. Maybe just tired of it.
It's the first time you noticed?
Exactly. And I said, you know what? We've got the SEC returning to football this weekend. I could get some good fall golf in. Manny's turning 8 in a month. I'm going to check out till close to the election and pick up later.
I have friends who say, you know, you're a thoughtful guy, you're a principled guy, Book of Virtues. How come you just don't go crazy, you know, dealing with these issues? I said, wife, family, faith, football.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily in that order.
Mm-hmm, of course. It can change from day to day as well.
It's my high school line coach, or my head coach, actually. Remember, boys, three most important things in life, faith, family, and football, and not necessarily in that order.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. Sure. No, I mean, you gotta turn it off. Problem with a lot of those jobs is they never can turn it off. They can't turn it off because they're on call all the time, which makes me wonder so much why people want to do it again and again and again.
Mm.
they could go out, they could make more money, they could have more time. I remember when I talked to Phil Graham, I think it's all right to repeat, I've said it before, I think, and he asked me, this was 96, whether I'd support him in his campaign. I said, oh, I'm just leaving it open. And I said, how are you feeling? He said, I'm very excited. He said, I've scheduled 150 fundraisers in the next 70 days, and it's just going to be great. And I remember I thought, Seth gave me the expression, Seth Leibson, our colleague and friend, 150 receptions in 70 days. I would rather sew my face to the floor.
Right. Yeah.
How are you? A guy told me, who was trying to encourage me, a well-known guy, I won't repeat it, he was trying to encourage me to run for president. He said, now, you do have to put up with people. I said, yeah, I know. Going to receptions, and a guy writes a check, and then he grabs you and lets you leave the reception and says, now, the thing you really got to worry about is it's like the guy in The Graduate who says, remember this, Benjamin, one word, plastics. Mm-hmm. The guy says, just take care of that. This guy did it to me, actually, at a big birthday party in Charlotte for my mother-in-law. A guy grabbed me and said, what's Bush going to do about chemicals? I said, I don't know. Mm-hmm. He pressed me again. I don't know. Pressed me through. I said, I don't know anything about chemicals. I have no damn idea. Mm-hmm. Guy got mad, told my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law got mad. Oh, she told Lane.
Oh, no.
Lane said, what, couldn't you have said something? I said, no, I don't know anything about chemicals. Mm-hmm. Talked to my brother. My brother's better on this stuff. He said, you know, and the third time, you should have just pulled the guy over and said, from what I hear, chemicals are going to be okay. I said, but he said, get the guy off your back. Just forget it.
That's good advice.
Guy calls you 6 months later. He says, hey, chemicals weren't okay. Mm-hmm. You just say, yeah, I was misinformed.
Yeah.
But don't get people mad at you. Just so this is why... That great line in Coriolanus, Shakespeare's play, I will go to them most counterfeitly. They tell this guy who's a fighter and a warrior, you know, he's got to put on the penitent's robe and ask the people's forgiveness. Mm-hmm. He doesn't like the people.
Right.
So I will not go to them most counterfeitly. Mm-hmm. There's a better world elsewhere, he says. Well, I'm not sure there is, but.
Yeah, right.
But there's politics at every place, and all jobs, but it's politics in monasteries.
That's
monk
true.
Told me the L power structure. Did I ever tell you my monk joke?
No.
So I've told it to everyone who's worked for me.
Okay.
So part of the opening interview, I'm surprised.
Okay.
A young monk joins a monastery. Mm-hmm. Here's all the rules. So now the most important rule is 2 words every 10 years. That's all you're allowed. It's an oath of silence. 2 words every 10 years. Young monk goes off, comes back 10 minutes later, and sees the abbot. And the abbot says, how's it going? He says, cold food. Goes off 10 years later, comes back. Abbott says, how's it going? He says, hard bet. Abbott says, you're fired. The young monk says, why? Only 2 words. Said, you've been complaining since the day you got here.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. Remind you of early morning in America. Oh,
there you go. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, man. Well, I'll be back in it by the end of the week. It just gets tiring after a
while. Oh, I know. No, you will not be able to resist.
Yeah, I can't.
It's like my buddy, our buddy, Brian, I'll not mention his name, but he's not watching the NFL.
Huh.
Because he's not going along with all the social justice stuff and can't stand to get all the things in the end zone, Black Lives Matter, and he just thinks, it's just do football. You know, just do football. And this is, as you know, he's a perfectly good guy. He's perfectly, you know, American Declaration of Independence. He's colorblind. He just doesn't like all the falderol. Mm-hmm. So I said, how about them Raiders? He said, I'm not watching. I'm boycotting them. I don't like all of them. I'm boycotting them. Mm-hmm. I said, they're great. He said, yeah, I guess the score was. I said, how do you know the score? He said, my wife was watching in the other room.
Of course.
Shouting out the score. I said, I know your wife. Your wife isn't watching in the other room. So, just on football, Darren Waller. Wow. The Raiders beat Saints, which was a huge upset. Opening of the stadium out there. Wow. They call it the Death Star, you know.
Right.
Raiders.
I mean, imagine life there now in Las Vegas. I mean, if you are, no matter where you're from, Milwaukee and you're a Packers fan, you know, Dallas and you're a Cowboys fan, Washington and you're a football team fan, and your team is playing the Raiders on a Sunday night or a Monday night or even a Sunday, who wouldn't want to take that road trip? Go to Vegas, catch a game, enjoy Las Vegas?
I'll tell you some people who wouldn't.
Okay.
People who would like to sit in the stadium. Right. I mean, right. You know, I can't tell you how furious I'm sure the people in Vegas are.
Oh, yeah, sure they can.
Bought season tickets. Here's the opener. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible stadium. Beautiful.
Right.
And, you know, these people are, a lot of them are gamblers anyway, you know, and the COVID thing, and they say they can't go, and then they right. have this upset game.
Yeah.
People mad, but, yeah, no kidding.
Wow.
Hotels out there, you know they're going to comp seats, and mm-hmm. they'll sit in the suite for the high rollers.
Absolutely.
Very Vegas thing. Did you watch any of it?
I did. I watched most of the first half.
Yeah, the commercials were showing the strip and, you know, playing it up.
Of course.
Playing Viva Las Vegas mm-hmm. by Elvis and, you know, Frank Sinatra. So it was very cool. But tell us quickly about Darrell Waller.
He caught your
Darren. Yeah. Well, he caught my eye, and he caught 14 passes,
caught a lot of passes
or 12 too. Or 13 or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's not necessarily his on field play that caught your attention. It's his story. So he was born in
Lamb. I am the former drug czar.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of a story of redemption, second chances, giving people a shot. Yes, well, third and fourth chances, really.
Born in
Landover, Maryland.
How far is that from you?
Maybe 20 minutes from you. Yeah. Going in different directions. And actually where my mother lives now.
Okay, where you go with the empty plate.
Exactly,
stuff.
For Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Load up.
Where I lived since I was 19 years old.
Okay.
And until I moved out as an adult. And born in Landover, Maryland. His great-grandfather was jazz musician Fats Waller.
Big name.
So he went to Georgia Tech. He was drafted 204th overall in the 2015 draft by the Ravens. And so they signed him to a four-year deal worth close to $3 million, and he was placed on injury on the IR in 2015, which ended his season that year. Now, in 2016, the following year, he was suspended for the first four games for violating the substance abuse policy of the NFL.
Okay.
Then in 2017, he was suspended for a year for, again, violating the substance abuse policy. So you see kind of a trend here with him. So he was reinstated 2018 by the league after that one-year suspension, and he was waived by the Ravens and signed to the practice squad the next day. So then the Raiders, fast forward to 2018, signed him to off the Ravens practice squad, and during the 2018 season he had six receptions, 75 yards. So it's kind of, I guess, working his way back in, right? So he's featured on HBO's Hard Knocks.
Saw that. Watch that. My son's put me onto that.
Yeah.
Features the Raiders in training camp.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they featured his story in one episode about his struggle with substance abuse and the steps that he took to kind of overcome it. So in 2019 with the Raiders against the Broncos, he caught, seven passes for 70 yards, and he just started to work his way back up. Week three against Minnesota, he finished with 134 rushing receiving yards on 13 attempts, and that was his first game over 100 yards, and has just been with the Raiders ever since. And you know the story about him, you know, maybe thinking about leaving and quitting, and Gruden says no.
Yeah, apparently, I've heard this. I can't confirm it, but Gruden said, you know, this is Hard Knocks out here, but, you know, we'll stay with us. He liked the potential, kept the guy, and the guy's clean. He has every incentive now. I like it because it's a story of redemption.
Yeah.
I guess I like it, too, because I was a drug czar, but here's this incredibly talented guy. Mm-hmm. Out of our neighborhood, your neighborhood,
yes.
Where you grew up, mm-hmm. goes to Georgia Tech, which is a serious university, by the way. He's probably brighter than most of your
right.
tight ends.
Sure.
Don't mean to cast dispersions.
Well, and we talk about this. I mean, there are some schools, colleges that are lenient towards their athletes, and there are some that are not. Georgia Tech's not.
Yeah, okay? No, I know. It's
so
very
you've got to be able to get into the school.
So this guy's got every reason now to stay clean.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real success story, and great for the Raiders, great for Gruden.
Mm-hmm.
I like Gruden. He's a tough guy. You know, I can tell you when it comes to drugs, tough love is often the right thing to do. Mm-hmm.
And you talk about the power of coaches in lives
in
of
the
men,
lives
just
of
like this guy, Darren Waller.
Absolutely.
And he didn't just fail once. I mean, he was suspended for four games and suspended for an entire year.
Yeah, I know.
People give up on you after one or two.
No, you gotta watch this guy. It's great. Stay current on the threat posed by China with our friends at Committee on the Present Danger China. Go to presentdangerchina.org. presentdangerchina.org.
You're listening to the Bill Bennett Show. Bill Bennett
Show. Well, John Hinderacher, welcome back. And we had a lot to talk about when we talked last week. And now I think we got something else to talk about. Holy smokes, John.
There's no shortage, Bill. There's no shortage, man alive.
Claude was saying this morning, he said, man, I'm just turning off the politics. I'm just going to watch football. I said, I'm going to watch football too, but this is not the time to turn off, man. This is as exciting as any SEC game. Excuse the expression.
Well, I'm not sure.
Excuse the expression.
I'm not sure
you... I didn't mention Big Ten. Excuse me. Why didn't I mention Big Ten, John?
Hey, they're going to play. They're belatedly starting a season. But, Bill, I'm not sure you can watch football without politics anymore either.
That's right. No, that's true. That's true. That's true. No, I know. I know. That's not. We got enough to talk about. I want to get to the Supreme Court, obviously. But can we start with elections? Because let's start locally and expand. Is Minnesota in play?
I hope so. The campaigns obviously think that it is. Joe Biden even came to Minnesota, although why he bothered, I don't know. He spoke to an empty room, read the speech off a teleprompter, didn't take any questions, and left. They didn't even allow local reporters into the room. And the only explanation I can think of for that is that they can trust the national reporters not to mention certain things, but they're afraid the local reporters might actually comment on Biden's appearance, his frailness, the fact that he's reading off a teleprompter, the fact that there's nobody actually in the Union Hall where the, you know, maybe 10 people, reporters, where the event is taking place. So apparently the Biden campaign thinks Minnesota may be in play as well. No Republican has won a statewide race in Minnesota since 2006.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a long losing streak, and you have to say Republicans are underdogs until they break it.
Well, you see the news this morning about Florida and Arizona? I mean, it was dead heat. Now, now ABC Washington Post, not exactly sympathetic to the president, has Trump up by 4 in Florida. That's a lot.
Well, you know, in 2016, a lot of people forget this, you know, but in 2016, the polls showed Trump closing late. I think the same thing's going to happen this year as people really focus on the election and on the candidates. And a lot of people are kind of forgetting about the debates, but I think it makes a big difference how many people watch those debates and how Joe Biden does. You know, if he can't rise to the occasion, a heck of a lot better than he has been in his occasional forays from his basement, you know, it's going to be a big deal.
You know, you mentioned the basement, you mentioned the empty room. One ad that I thought about, I'm sure they get thousands of emails like this, but is to show the rooms where Biden is and then show these places where Trump is.
Right, exactly.
Just a sea of people there in where was he?
If there was like a visitor from outer space and you showed him those contrasts and said, the guy that can't draw more than 12 people to an empty room, he's the guy that most people think is going to win the election, they'd think you were crazy.
By the way, that guy from outer space is going to get an absentee ballot.
Well, at least he exists, Bill.
I guess. So, you know. Let's talk. That was a great thing. We talk about serious issues. We have a lot of fun. That's why I love talking with John. John, you wrote a little piece on Powerline, which we love, which our listeners love, about the absentee stuff. I'm really worried about this. I mean, really worried.
Worried about it. You absolutely should be worried for several reasons. But let's start with my state of Minnesota, because we're typical. A lot of states are doing this. The state of Minnesota, which has a Secretary of State, by the way, devoted to the goal of maximizing voter fraud. But the state of Minnesota has taken the position that voting in person is kind of a second best alternative, that really, you know, people should be voting online or by absentee ballot. And they have literally mailed out an absentee ballot application every person in Minnesota who's on the registered voter list, which has got to be a couple million. You know, it's unbelievable. And this is happening in state after state. Millions of these absentee ballot applications are being mailed out. And I wrote about this on Powerline, and I put up pictures of some of these documents. And the absentee ballot application gives you three options. One is, I have a Minnesota driver's license, and this is the number. That's number one. Number two is, I have a Social Security number. The last four digits are, you know, XYZ. Well, every single person I know of has got one or the other or both, a driver's license or a Social Security number. But then you have option three. I don't have a Minnesota-issued driver's license or a Social Security number. And if you check that box, it says your identification number will be compared to the one on your absentee ballot envelope. Well, then you say, well, what identification number is that? And the only answer to that question is that there's a barcode on the return envelope that's included that you put your application for an absentee ballot into. So what they now know is that somebody has mailed them an envelope that's got this number on it, right, with an application. And then when they send you the ballot, you fill out the ballot and put it in that envelope, they'll compare those numbers and they'll say, sure enough, you know, sure enough, we got a ballot. Wow. But that doesn't tell you anything about who actually filled out the ballot. Nothing whatsoever. There's zero security there. And what makes this really problematic, Bill, is that these voter registration lists are so bad. So I wrote a bit about this on Powerline after I got a couple of texts from a friend who told me that his absentee ballot application had come in the mail, as mine had. But he said, I got three of them. He said, I got one addressed to me, and I got two sent to my house, addressed to the two people who owned the house before I did and now live in Florida. And I've gotten the same report from multiple friends who have said, hey, you know, I got a ballot application, you know, mailed to my house. And one guy said, I'm the only person who's ever lived in this house. I built it. And I got delivered to my house with my home address on it, a ballot application in the name of a person I've never heard of and who can't possibly have ever lived here.
Wow.
So they're basically, you know, so there are these millions, literally millions of absentee ballot applications floating around the state. And there is no effective security to prevent a whole lot of them from being fraudulently filled out. Here's the other thing, Bill. Minnesota law provides that any absentee ballot signature has to be witnessed. So at least it takes two to commit a fraud, right? I mean, it's not a big speed bump, but it's a speed bump. You know, if you're going to fraudulently fill out an absentee ballot, at least you got to have one other person who's willing to witness it. Well, this year, as a result of a collusive settlement between the Democrats and the Democrat Secretary of State, that requirement has been waived for this election. So if you want to fill out somebody else's name, you don't need a witness anymore.
Unbelievable. Can anything be done? Is anything being done? Should something be done? What can be done?
Well, the answers to those questions are different. Something should have been done a long time ago, Bill. I think it's probably too late now. Think about this, too. You know, in a state like Minnesota, and again, I think we're the rule, not the exception. You know, the authorities are encouraging not showing up at the polls. And so let's assume, I think typically, you know, I think 2.5 million votes will be cast in Minnesota in this election, something like that, right? And probably, you know, 1 million to 1.5 million of them are likely to be cast absentee or mail-in, you know. And just think about this for a minute, because every single one of those ballots is going to have to be checked against the voting in-person voter rolls to make sure that person isn't voting twice. You know, you don't want people showing up at the polls and having already mailed in an absentee ballot gives them two votes, right? So at a minimum, 1 million to 1.5 million ballots are going to have to be checked to make sure that this person whose name is on it, whether he really filled it out or not, who knows, but his name is on it, you know, hasn't voted twice. And I don't know how that's going to happen. I mean, in Minnesota, ballots can be received up to a week after election day and still be counted.
I was just going to say it's not going to happen November 3rd, right? No.
Oh, hell no. I don't even know where the manpower is going to come from, you know, to deal with these millions of absentee ballots in state after state. You remember was it 2006? When was it? When we had the Coleman-Franken election.
Right. Coleman won or looked like
he
won.
Well, he seemed to win on election day. He was ahead by 400 votes or something. But then there was the process that went on for weeks of analyzing and debating absentee ballots. Well, in that case, there were like, I don't know what, 3,000 absentee ballots or five, I don't know what, you know, a few thousand. And that process went on for weeks and resulted in litigation and endless controversy. Well, take that and now imagine, you know, a million absentee ballots, you know, and not just in one state, but in 15 states. I think we're looking at a fiasco.
Well, supposing it goes past, what's the date? Last president's last date, January 20th, is when the inaugural is, right? So,
yeah.
So supposing the count, take the numbers, you know, it's 3,000 and then multiply it times 50 or whatever, 100. And if it goes past, what happens? Do we have any precedent? We don't have any precedent for this. Does the president stay? If the president stays,
no,
people will, you know, will go nuts. If he doesn't stay, people will go nuts.
In my opinion, Bill, this is why the Democrats for some time now have been floating this kind of seemingly insane theory about how President Trump will lose the election but refuse to vacate the White House, yeah. And the army will have to come and drag him out. They've been talking about this for months, and I always thought that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. But I think now that they were foreseeing the idea that by January 20th, we're supposed to be arguing about who won the election. And they're trying to lay the groundwork for somehow evicting President Trump when the Republicans believe that, you know, he's been reelected.
Short question. Is it right to assume that most of the fraudulent ballots that will come in will be Democrat?
Well, that's what the Democrats think. You know, that's why all the Democrat secretaries of state try to facilitate voter fraud.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And they go crazy. Anytime you advocate the least, you know, measure for ballot security, they go nuts. So, yeah, they obviously think they benefit from it.
By the way, do you know, someone asked me this, and I couldn't look at it and find it. Was Bush v. Gore as close as Trump v. Clinton? Was it closer?
In terms of popular vote?
Yes, and electoral vote. Probably popular vote.
Well, popular vote was closer. Popular vote, Bush v. Gore, was like 500,000. So that was closer.
Okay.
Electorally, Trump won by a bigger margin than Bush did in 2000.
So interesting. Okay. By way of transition then, John Hinderacher, and again, folks, read Powerline. John, all right, by way of transition, so let's assume, like Bush v. Gore, that there's some mess, it somehow gets to the Supreme Court. Is that, first of all, a reasonable assumption?
Well, I guess so. I mean, the closest thing we have to a precedent is Bush v. Gore, and this is going to be a lot more complicated. For one thing, it won't be just one state. You know, it'll probably
be
multiple states.
All right, so let's assume it gets to the Supreme Court. This becomes one argument, a big argument, I think, for having a 9-court justice, not an 8-court justice.
Well, it's a good argument for a nine justice court,
sorry,
and Ted
corrected.
Cruz, for one, has made the argument very effectively. Of course, the Democrats don't see it that way. You know, they'd rather have a 4-4 court. You know, that presumably would, or at least likely, would be a 4-4 tie.
No, but whatever they'd like or Republicans like, the math is the math. It's better to have 9 than 8 if you're looking for a decision.
I have no doubt about that. Yeah. Well, if you want to play out things that could just be farcical. You know, a 4-4 Supreme Court leaves undisturbed the decision of the court below. Well, you know, then the decision effectively gets made not by the Supreme Court, but by one of the, you know, 12 or 13 courts of appeals. And if multiple states are in play, there could be multiple courts of appeals ruling on different things, and they might be ruling differently. And all of those rulings would then be left in place. And, you know, you could easily spin out scenarios that are just totally unacceptable.
By the way, I mean, I don't want to get inside baseball here, but I just made the assumption it gets to the court. I don't know how it gets to the court. How does it get to the court? I mean, you know.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how it gets to the court in time, you know. And you know, I've been talking about federal courts of appeal, but you know, the way that that Bush v. Gore got to the Supreme Court was via the Supreme Court of Florida.
But this could be multiple, so you know, possible that Trump's around till Easter and then Biden comes in. I'm just
I really I, okay. I don't know.
You don't know.
and no one knows. I mean, there's no precedent for this. And this is, by the way, Bill, this illustrates why we have historically had an election day, right? You have an election day and you count the ballots. And yeah, there's a few absentee ballots, and occasionally that creates a problem, like with the Coleman-Franken race, you know. But basically, you have an election day. Now, we've got election season, you know, with this profusion of mail-in ballots, and it's a completely different animal. One last thing we should add to the mix, Bill, is, you know, the Electoral College has to meet, you know, and I believe, I haven't looked this up, but I believe that there's a statute that dictates that the Electoral College meets on a certain day, like, you know, December something, I think. And so one of the things that happens here, you know, before Inauguration Day and likely before the Supreme Court could ever get into the act, is that the Electoral College has to meet. And how does that work? You know, there's going to be a debate, I think, in a number of states ongoing, probably, about who are the right electors. You know, I don't know. The Constitution provides that the ultimate recourse, if nobody gets a majority in the Electoral College, then it goes, I believe I'm saying this correctly. If nobody gets a majority, then it goes to the House of Representatives and the states vote. You know, each state gets one vote. That's the ultimate recourse in the Constitution. And of course, there are more Republican states than Democrat states.
So then he wins.
If it got to that level. But again, this we are in uncharted waters. You know, nobody knows.
Wow. I think it's a big deal. I don't think enough's being made of it.
It's a huge deal, Bill. I mean, the hysteria we've been living through for the last several years, we ain't seen nothing yet. And bear in mind, Bill, that all of this craziness with counting and recounting ballots, you know, in some states, I'm not sure how many states, but at least in some states, they've got voter signatures on file. And I believe that the process would be to compare a signature, at least in some states, on an absentee ballot to a signature that they have on file for the vote. At least I hope some states have that process. Well, imagine that. You've got two judges, a Republican judge and a Democrat judge. And the Democrat judge says, yeah, it looks like the same signature to me. And the Republican judge says, are you kidding? You know, that wasn't signed by the same person. This is a fraudulent ballot. Okay, do that about 50,000 times. But keep in mind that while all of this is going on, the counting, the recounting, the lawsuits, the debate, the hysteria, there's likely also going to be rioting going on. You know, the Democrats have basically said, we get our way or we burn down the cities.
Okay, the only good I can think coming out of this is one of my regrets in life. I have a couple of regrets in life. I didn't meet Elaine Glover Bennett earlier. I didn't serve in the military, and I didn't major in classics. I was close. I majored in philosophy, but I didn't major in classics. The fourth one is I didn't stay up for the final Trump count. Did you? You did.
I stayed up pretty late.
It was looking good, but I went to sleep. This time, I can go to bed, and unless I'm Rip Van Winkle, I'll be up in time.
Unfortunately, that's true. There is no way. And, you know, the Democrats, again, they've been doing battle space preparation. They've been putting articles in newspapers and magazines and so on, saying, you know, it probably is going to look on election night like Trump has won. It may even look like Trump has won in a landslide, but don't believe it. We're going to count and count and count, and eventually Biden is going to win.
I know, and there'll be so much celebration by the Trump people, and that will just make them giving it up, if that should be the final verdict, even harder. Anyway, okay, let's get, because we have limited time. God knows you're very generous with your time. I want to get to one other thing, which is the reason I called you to come on, which is Princeton, the alma mater of my boys. My younger son flew to Dartmouth the day the football coach punched out the Holy Cross football coach. You may remember that, the Dartmouth Holy Cross game. Do you remember this?
I don't. When was that? That must have been after my time.
Oh, it was after your time. No, Joe's very young. But he was at Princeton that morning being interviewed. And Joe is 6'6", 260. He's a Marine. And they wanted to get him up to 290. But the only day that he could be interviewed at Dartmouth was the day of the Holy Cross game. And he got up there, and the coach was and he was up there. And it was apparently an overtime or disputed something. And Stevens punched the Holy Cross coach or a player. I can't remember. And then interviewed my son. My son said, I kind of like this guy. He's serious. I said, yeah, he is. He's serious.
Ivy League football is not usually that serious. I kind of like that story.
All right, Princeton. So Princeton has confessed to institutional racism, and it's just everywhere. I mean, I saw it for 8 years. I just saw people not being allowed to get on buses and people not being allowed to. I mean, it's ridiculous, totally ridiculous. Talk about a privileged community and a, you know, place.
Oh, it's so ridiculous. So the president of Princeton wrote this letter to the Princeton community, and it's the typical kind of thing that we're seeing all over the place. You know, pleading guilty, and big mea culpa, you know, systemic racism, institutional racism. We have it here at Princeton. It damages students of color, blah, blah, blah. So the Department of Justice wrote this brilliant letter to the president of Princeton saying, oh, you have systemic racism that damages your black students? We want to know more about that, because if it's true, you're in violation of Title VI. And also, you've been certifying every year when you get federal funds that you don't discriminate. And so it sounds like those certifications might not be true in the federal government. We might need to ask for our money back. And so it asks for an interview with the president. It asks for a whole bunch of documents. For example, a spreadsheet identifying each person who has been on the ground of race, color, or national origin, excluded from participation in or been denied the benefits of blah, blah, blah. In other words, you know, you black students have been damaged. Give us their names. And it wants documents and answers to questions. So I think this is
genius. Let me interrupt you. Will they interview students too?
I think they will. I mean, in the normal course, I think they would. I don't know. I don't know.
I got a thought on that. Finish yours, and then I want to throw something out at you.
Well, the big picture point I would make about this is, and of course, the president of Princeton responded publicly, expressing outrage that they can be so presumptuous as to take his words seriously. Basically, you know, and my read on this, Bill, is that all this stuff about systemic racism is complete and pure BS. And the president of Princeton knows it, and the faculty knows it, and the students know it. The truth is that Princeton and every other educational institution and every company in America has been engaging in what's called affirmative action for 50 years.
Yeah.
And what that means is they do discriminate on the basis of race, but they discriminate in favor of blacks and certain other minorities, not all minorities. But that's the reality. Everybody knows it. And so I think that the president of Princeton is nonplussed that his you know, ritual, you know, confession to systemic racism has actually been taken seriously.
Now, most people I've talked to said, well, this investigation will start and then it will end, because obviously they'll not find Bull Connor and, you know, there won't be young black women being blocked from entering Princeton instruction halls and so on. I mean, I'm not so sure. That's why I asked you whether you think the Department of Ed, I would urge them to, that they'll talk to students, because they'll talk to some students who will say, yeah, because they have this heightened sensitivity. Do you remember the subject? I think I have this right, of Michelle Obama's senior thesis at Princeton.
And it was, I don't.
And it was about, I believe I have this right. I'm going to ask Claude to look it up when we're off. But I think it was about how she encountered racism at Princeton. I mean, hard as it may be to believe, but, you know, you got a certain situation where any slight, which any person of any race might receive on a weekly, monthly, daily basis, is interpreted racially. If it happens to a person of certain color and sensitivity, you know, someone bumps into you,
the college campuses are also rife with hoaxes.
Right, but the other thing
people
is
people look for opportunities to create, you know, racist incidents that didn't happen. So your point is well taken. If they go and interview a bunch of black Princeton students, they probably will find some who will say, oh, yeah, you know, I've been discriminated against.
But let me go a step further. They interview the faculty, and they will find faculty members who say, yeah, microaggressions here. White supremacy reigns. right? I mean, it will.
Yeah, I suppose that's right.
There'll be testimony, unless what's Ice Gruber is going to send a note out. Faculty, please don't say there's any racism. And You know, I don't believe they'll get a clean slate report from every member of the faculty.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, to me, the most entertaining outcome might be if the Department of Justice writes a letter that says, President Eisgruber, you were wrong. There is no systemic racism at Princeton. And Eisgruber would say, yes, there is.
Right.
You know?
Right. Oh, yeah, there is.
I mean,
come back. You didn't look deep enough.
I mean, you know, it's the whole thing. You may be right. I mean, if they seriously, you know, want to find some instances of discrimination, I suppose they could find people at Princeton who would vouch for them. But I think the real mission here ought to be to expose just the foolishness and falsity of the whole systemic racism shtick.
Hope so. Hope so, but this thing gets weirder and weirder, so we'll see. We'll see. All right, anything else? I'm looking forward to watching the opening of the SEC season, and I guess you guys are going to start in order around Christmas time?
A little before Halloween, Bill. A little. I think if you hold off until October 24, you can see some real football in the Big Ten.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Yeah, yeah. You know, did you know my idea about all this when COVID thing, I said, look, just no matter what happens, if there were nuclear war, the SEC would play, right?
You know, it's a good thing, too.
And I said, and just get Clemson, you know, get Vanderbilt out of the SEC over to the ACC, get Clemson into the SEC, and you're going to have the top four teams in the country anyway. Sorry, Ohio State. You had your chance. I was kind of for the Gophers last year because they were looking pretty strong.
The Gophers are good. They're going to be good again this year.
Trump was really up to something funny the other day. I don't know. It's just so wicked. I just said, get off it. And then I couldn't wait to hear more. He said, Biden's really attached to that mask, isn't he? He really loves that. He does. He kind of fondles it.
You know, Bill, this is something that's really primal in human nature. You know, you think back to the days of the caveman, you know, when people are choosing leaders and you know, all through human history, you got Donald Trump, who's obviously a strong man, a strong individual, strong personality. He's not wearing a mask. He'll put one on here and there, but when he does a rally, he's sure as heck not wearing a mask.
And they're not either.
And they got 15,000 people cheering for him. And then you got the other guy who looks like he ought to be coming on stage in a walker, you know, who has to be led by one of his handlers. And he comes out there and he's wearing a mask, you know. I mean, how beta is that? And when in all of human history has there been a time when people would choose as their leader the frail guy in the mask?
I think you're right, but I don't know where we are. I don't know where we are, for sure. I wish I were confident. I believe it. If I were a betting man, I'd bet it, and I may bet it. But I'm not sure. Are you sure?
No, I'm in the same boat as you, Bill. I mean, all to me, logic points. You know, I was one of the few people who predicted that Trump would win in 2016. And it wasn't because I really understood his appeal to some voters. I didn't get it then. I get it now, but I didn't then. But I predicted Trump was going to win because I did understand that Hillary Clinton was a horrible candidate.
Yeah.
And I said, all this stuff about what a powerhouse she is BS. She's a terrible candidate. She's not going to win. Well, compared to Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton was Abraham Lincoln. I mean, you know, I don't see this guy. He can't make it through a paragraph.
I know.
I can't see this guy getting elected. But then, of course, we're looking at the endless counting and recounting and the mail-in ballots that come from God knows where. Who knows?
John, thank you. You're the best. Always fun. Always great.
Hey, thank you, Bill.
Okay, that does it for today's show. To catch up on previous episodes of the show, go to thebillbennettshow.com. Mrs. Bennett said, how do I find the show? I said, ask Claude.
Okay,
yeah,
right.
But I mean, I should know. You can follow me on Twitter at William J. Bennett. You can like me on Facebook. Just search Bill Bennett. Feel free to email the show. I'd love to hear from you. It's BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com. Share the podcast with your family and with your friends. We'll catch up next week. Okay, Claude?
All right.
Good.